Okay, good evening. My name's Pat. I'm an alcoholic. I'm calling from Beacon Street in Boston. Still snow. Tonight we're going to talk about Sam Shoemaker. As Mike says, he always talks about the slender threads running through the fabric of AA. Tonight, I want to remind you that not all of the threads were alcoholic threads. Sam was not an alcoholic. In fact, I couldn't find anybody in his family who was an alcoholic, but he certainly was a golden thread, and he brought an awful lot of stability and value and sound influence into Alcoholics Anonymous when we needed it. Reading his books and listening to his talks, and somebody asked me the other day, how do you find out that I've read a ton of Sam Shoemaker's books. That's how come I come up with this stuff. I don't find any... what do they call them? Cliff notes on these guys. I mean, sometimes you have to sit down and do just the old fashioned reading, and you will find that the truth repeats itself over and over, particularly in religious writers such as Sam Shoemaker. So it's not like you're reading a history book. But Sam's words still remain uncredited in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I think he wished to have it that way. He just wanted to do what God guided him to do. He had a soft touch. And his people at Cavalry Church, particularly Irving Harris, called him the breeze of the Holy Spirit. It may surprise you, but in Sam's life, Alcoholics Anonymous is just an asterisk, it's a footnote. He stood by the door. That's a poem that people would know, and it says he encouraged other people to enter and do the right thing. Now, how do I move it next? How does it move next? Is it frozen? Okay, yeah. There we go. Yeah. Okay. Sam Shoemaker, from his early interactions with Frank Bookman, First Century Christianity, the Emmanuel Movement, Courtney Baylor, and the Jacobi Club, and his time with Richard Peabody, Harry Hadley, Sam Crocker, Franklin Chambers, Charlie Clapp, Roland Hazard, and Victor Kitchen. It's like an all-star team. Jim Newton, Walter Tunks, the Firestones, Henrietta Sieverling, and the Smiths in Akron, and continuing to his death in 1963. He was the most prominent and consistently present non-alcoholic involved in the founding and development of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I stood by the door. That's his library. Here's one of the people. Every time I pick up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that I'm being influenced by Sam. And as Bill Wilson said, nobody invented Alcoholics Anonymous. It grew by trial and error and has produced a rich experience. Little by little, we have been adopting the lessons of experience, first as policy, then as traditions, and that policy still goes on and it never stops. The Shoemakers were Quakers from Germany, and they arrived in the Middle America, the Middle Atlantic states, in the 1700s. And added a couple of Southern ties from New Orleans, et cetera, through marriage. Their ancestors included a mayor of Philadelphia, the founder of the Great Western Express Company, clipper ship owners, businessmen, lawyers, judges, and educators. In the mid-1860s, actually right after the Civil War, the Shoemakers settled north of Baltimore in the Green Spring Valley after his grandfather acquired Burnside, which was an estate of close to 500, maybe even 600 acres that remained in the family right into at least until the 60s. They were backbones of their community and in the Episcopal Church in particular, and Sam was raised in a strong, faith-centered, low Episcopal family. He learned to seek God's inspiration and wisdom and guidance by observing how his family worked. He didn't have to be taught much. He saw that they performed daily service to others. The family was really quite wealthy, and this is more of their farm. The family ritual, they had greenhouses on that estate, and so they used to use the flowers to go ahead and decorate the churches, particularly around Baltimore, around the Christmas holidays and Easter. That was a big thing. They'd take a wagon, the whole family would go in and decorate a church. They were just a little bit too much. They were pretty nice people. In 1908, they wanted to get him out of there, so they sent him to the St. George's Episcopal Prep School in Newport, Rhode Island, from Maryland, where he began his academic and his spiritual career. establishing codes and relationships and lifetime contacts. Some of his fellow students included Richmond Walker, the guy that wrote the 24-hour book, Thomas Hazard, who was Roland Hazard's younger brother, and Prescott Bush, the grandfather and great-grandfather of two presidents of the United States. That's the campus. My grandson played baseball there. I was there a couple of times. It's really quite a nice place. But I'll tell you how rich it is. One of my guys I sponsor went to that school. They have two indoor hockey rinks at St. George's School. His interest grew. Diamond was the head when he was there. He actually was an Episcopal priest who went on and became a Catholic priest and founded Portsmouth Priory, which is right down the line. But anyway, religion was in the game. And while he was there, he went ahead and he attended the Northfield Bible Conferences in Northfield, Massachusetts, which were founded by Dwight Moody, who lived in Northfield. That's where he originally was from before he found all of his success. And they based it out of the Northfield School for Girls. Dwight Moody was one of the pioneering evangelists in the United States and abroad. He brought his own. He had a choir director. He had the whole routine. They used to build these buildings. They were temporary buildings they would build just for these things. Would come in for 2 weeks, maybe a month. Up and around Northfield on a regular basis, and they go on today. They had the Bible conferences, and clones of the Bible conferences started throughout Europe and the middle America. They started as camps, and then they took over the whole school. It became a big thing. You got to remember that this is in the early 1900s, before World War I, and evangelists were rock stars. I mean, they were filling these massive stadiums and halls. They attracted people. You had all of the Billy Sundays and the Dwight Moody's and Robert Elliott Speer on the left, and John Mott, who dropped out of Cornell to become an evangelist, and Sherwood Eddy. They had a robust faith. I think it was Roosevelt that used to call it muscular Christianity. But there was an arrogance with it too, which was strange, because they considered the rest of the world as heathens, you know. And I think today that would not be quite politically correct. But world Christian conversion was what they wanted to go ahead and do. Bring Christ to the world before we die. That was one of Robert Spears, that was Eddie, I believe, who said that. And they were able to attract young people right out of colleges. And this was also the time of some of the robber barons. So some of these people that had made vast fortunes in the early 1900s would go ahead and underwrite some of these missionaries going on. There was one big missionary, the guy that owned one of the major rapid transit in New York City, one of the elevated railways. He was a great sponsor of these people. I think in the Catholic Church, they call them purchasing indulgences to help you get back into heaven or something like that. Out of this came one of the examples they had was the seven missionaries out of Cambridge University in London. They held them up as idols. I mean, these were some of the captains of the sports teams and track men and tennis champions. And they all gathered together and they went to China to go ahead and to bring Christianity in. And they traveled throughout the world before they went. And actually, when you check into them, some of them actually lasted in China until 1945. I mean, these guys were dedicated. And it spawned that the student volunteer movement. This is one of the classes at the Northfield Summer Foreign Mission Group in 1886. There was the best and the brightest. And families used to go ahead and you wouldn't have to work in the summer. They'd send you there. This is at Mount Hermon, which was up in that same area with Northfield. The student volunteer movement created a faith atmosphere. And these were not clergymen. These were lay missionaries. And they brought aggressive personal Christian witnessing around the world. They were doing this before Frank Bookman showed up. But this is a couple of the pictures of some of the the assemblies that they had around the country. Some of their biggest targets were in Turkey and China, India, Japan, religious cooperation around the world. Some of the slogans that came out of that time were follow Christ in character and career, every man's life a plan of God. Horace Bushnell, that actually was Roland Hazard's great-grandfather. Surrender is the first step. Success will follow confession and decent Christian living. Pray, think, ask, do the next right thing. Act decisively. That was Dwight Moody. The morning watch, quiet time, as a the secret to a triumphant life. Dr. Moule and the Seventh-day Adventists. That was early on. God sends signals, and you'll need a clean receiving instrument. F.B. Meyer. He was one of Frank Bookman's guides early on with H.B. Wright. And the practice of two-way prayer, meditation, guidance, and check-in. A lot of that came from the Jesuits. Sam went off to Princeton as a young man. His father had gone to Princeton, and he was active in campus ministries and politics. He fit right in there, and he stayed. He had that fervor, that evangelical fervor, that fit right in there. Princeton at the time was heavily Presbyterian, but it was of all of the major schools in the United States back in this, from the 1700s through the late 1800s, were religious based, whether it be Boston University, Harvard, Yale. They all had a religious origin to them. They were there for training ministers. While he was there, he must have been pretty bright. I never saw his transcripts, but he took some YMCA assignments that they were offering. And one of them took him to be a lay minister to the troops on the Mexican border in 1916. He came back, and then he went over to England. Then he was a lay minister to some of the British Flying Corps pilots during the First World War. He didn't have to go into it. Back in those days, they would fly back and forth over the English Channel, and there were some great examples of him counseling. And he was a young guy at the time. And evidently he was a good listener, which was very important. After graduation, he joined Sherwood Eddy's recommendation and went to the Princeton in China program, which was teaching Chinese students English while trying to convert them to Christianity, and also establishing YMCAs. Western businesses had a dual motive on some of this stuff. They were underwriting this stuff, but they were also establishing contacts and influencing men and forming alliances through the missions. If you think there were a lot of people, there were 27,000 Western missionaries and staff in China in 1917, and they effected 26,000 conversions. That wasn't a good return on investment, so one-to-one. While he was there, he wasn't being very successful in making conversions, and Frank Bookman came through at the time. Now, Frank had started to go ahead and build a reputation. He was brash and controversial. He came under the umbrella of the YMCA, the Keswick Conventions. Like I mentioned before, H.B. Wright and F.B. Meyer were some of his guides. Sam went and talked to him and said, I'm not getting any of my boys to go ahead and to convert. And Sam said, maybe it's you. Maybe you're just too arrogant. I guess he must have really shocked Sam. And he told him that Sam's sins were standing in the way of his converting prospects. He told him to straighten himself out, that he was the problem. Surrender his will over to life with Christ on a daily basis. Seek guidance. Spend plenty of time on quiet time and prayer and meditation and listen. Sam pulled back and spent a couple of days and considered what Bookman said, and then said, geez, maybe he's right. And he did a deep moral inventory, completely surrendered to Christ, admitted his sins to another, one of his students, actually, sought God's guidance, and then listened for direction during his quiet time. And he hit the reset button on his life. And Sam began seeking and receiving God's guidance as never before. He adopted Shoemaker's conversion process, which Bookman liked slogans and snappy little sayings and stuff like that. He liked the five C's. One of the things, you don't find too many Frank Bookman books around if you start looking. He let other people do the writing. He encouraged them to write. I'm sure he took a piece of the royalties too, but that was his business. There we get a little bit off there. But Bookman had coined that five C's process, and it gave people an easy way to understand what they were supposed to be doing. I keep on having too many of these things drop off on me. But he molded that process, and he renamed it a first century Christian fellowship, which eventually became known as the Oxford Group. Sam returned to Princeton from China in 1919-1920 and took over a student organization called the Philadelphia Society, which was basically a Presbyterian on-campus evangelical type situation. And they were really quite strong, and they were once again very well financed on the Princeton campus. And it was to go ahead and to bring spirituality to the campus. And Sam followed that one-on-one conversion process that he had learned from Sam. And he actually invited Bookman and his team of what they called aggressive evangelists to witness on the campus. And they were popular, but not without controversy. And Bookman's sermon was banned. He got a persona non grata status from the campus. President Hibbler later went ahead and rescinded it. But I don't know exactly what it was like, but there was a lot of talk about relatively the public confessions that they were asking for. And I don't know if you've ever been in a meeting where some young person gets up and starts telling their story, and you at least in my area, they say, geez, that's one of those fifth steps you should take with the sponsor, not with a room of 150 people. And I think that's what was happening there. And there's a lot of challenges going on. There were some people that didn't like what was going on with Bookman either. He was he did get their attention. He claimed that hostile factions had spread the rumors, and the public confessions of sins were greatly exaggerated. Sam became a deacon at the time, which he was in the seminary, sort of outsourcing it a little bit. And then he went on to the New York General Seminary, and he was ordained in 1921. He sort of got advanced placement as far as in the Episcopal Church, and he was moved right along to become a curate at Grace Episcopal Church. And in 1924, with his bishop's permission, Sam joined up with Sam Bookman's Oxford-type team in Europe and the Middle East. But it wasn't too long that he was faced with a choice. Bookman had formed that first century Christian fellowship, and now called the Oxford Group, and he sought elite associates to his group and drew the best and the brightest into missionary work, the better to convert the top echelons than the lower classes. And he was going after he wanted to convert countries later on. But anyway, Europeans really welcomed the Oxford team. It was a very elite group. Sam valued their life-changing goals, and he joined Bookman he left Grace Church, and he went and he joined in the summer of 1924 on a Middle East team that was on its way to India and China. When he received a message, I believe they were in Egypt, he was offered to be the rector of the Calvary Episcopal Church in New York City. And Sam had to reassess his priority, and using prayer and meditation, he sought some guidance, and he thought about it for a couple of days and prayed on it, and he accepted the position and returned to New York City. Left Frank and the Oxford Group, but because he always wanted to have run a church, and the Calvary Episcopal Church was sort of an elderly church in New York City. It was the Church of the Roosevelts, etc. It's on 21st Street, but towards the end of the 19th century, the elite from New York started moving uptown into the 50s and the 60s on the and up towards Central Park, and the church was falling on hard times and it needed a jump start. So now he was given his own church mission, and he remained linked to the Oxford Group, and he became its nominal American leader, but he had his hands full with that church. As time passed, his style brought some results, but they weren't always in sync with what Sam wanted to do. Sam was more of a parish priest in many aspects of his life. The Calvary Episcopal Church needed revitalization, as I said, and he took it. He took it as a trial. I believe that they gave him a year or two. But once he hit the ground, they knew he was there. He immediately went ahead and brought an awful lot of activity into the church. Sunday afternoons and some weeknights he would lead processions out onto the nearby Madison Square in the city and lead them back to the Cavalry Church. Back in those days, a lot of people would go ahead and leave property and leave money, particularly property, though, to a church. And so what Sam did, he took a look at the inventory of this church, which included apartment buildings, land, et cetera, some, not always in the neighborhood. And he got permission from the vestry to go ahead and to sell some of that property and use the money to build a parish center adjacent to the church. And he was active. He started to hire staff, and they were facilitators and guides, and he put groups in motion and stepped back and let God work. He would turn over the responsibility of that, set up a guideline, an outline of what they wanted to accomplish. He'd name somebody the head of it, give him a couple of assistants, and then stand back. I like that poem. He stood by the door. I mean, he gave people a chance to go ahead and do what they wanted to. Cavalry House was completed in 1928 and had socials, settings, meeting, function spaces, libraries, offices, support areas, cafeterias, as well as living quarters for an awful lot of the staff members. And he also took some of the other buildings in the area and converted them into apartments for his staff, because he was out there actively recruiting. And he recruited not just caseworkers, as you would say, but he had choir masters, he had ministers, when he reached out, he didn't reach out just to Episcopals. I mean, he saw talent in someone of the Protestant faiths, he would go ahead and try to talk that person into joining his team. He worked with all the churches in New York, and he was a missionary in himself. And Cavalry became a very vibrant parish under the church. One of the things he did was that they had owned the Galilee Mission, which was nearby, and he saw that, and it had the Olive Tree House, which was like a rooming house nearby. And he went ahead and he activated that. He found two guys, Henry Hadley and Tex, and I forget Tex's last name, but he went ahead and he put them in charge of it, and they got that thing going again. Now, Hadley and Tex Francisco, I think his name was, had both gotten sober 20 years before, the turn of the century, and they had been on the road type temperance speakers, and they wanted to settle down. They came into town, and I think that I think that Sam Shoemaker let them have their run. He made sure they had the money, they had guidelines to do things, but Sam was the supporter of it. He was the patron. I don't think he was making bets. I think he was trying to make sure. He knew also, he was not an alcoholic, and he knew from his work earlier, he had been to Emmanuel Church, he knew Worcester, McComb, Coriat, Courtney Baylor, all of those people. He knew that the best person to work with an alcoholic was a recovering alcoholic. And both Hank Hadley and Tex had were that. And so he went ahead and he did the best. They reopened it in the spirit of Christianity. The men needed to run the mission returned. Sam knew sober alcoholics work best. Mission residents were down and outers. That was a New York term. Who showed up, cleaned up, and attended sermons, participated, stayed sober, and bunked at the inn. Working each day, they returned for food, safety, and fellowship at night. Sam stood at the door, offered support while inside. Hank and Tex provided the experience, hands-on help. This is the neighborhood that they were in. Madison Square is on the side, and that's Gramercy Park, which is a private park right in the middle of town. That was Sam's turf. Sam treasured pageantry and ceremony. He used to go ahead and lead. He had a band. He had trumpets playing and hymns singing, choirs, and they would walk out into Madison Square, and they would go ahead and sing and preach and witness. And he was quite a ham when necessary. He had no problem playing the showman to get your attention, have you take a deep look at Christianity. He wanted to let you know that it was going to be different here. He didn't believe his way was the only way. He enthusiastically attracted God seekers to find whatever would best suit their needs. And he was a recruiter for Christ, not just for the Oxford group, but for all evangelists. He played well with others in his community. He was quite a character. He had a theory that everyone has a problem. Everybody is a problem or has to live with the problem. And that's really pretty. It's a pretty good situation going on to today. He constantly tweaked his ministry practices. With his efforts, he brought God into the lives of more of his neighbors. He recruited staff from all walks of life. He was an outreacher and a challenger, and his affinity groups, or cells, he used to call them, would help those with common sins, needs, or problems. And they sought solutions, and often they were people who would not ordinarily admit. Now, the thing is, you had to want to go ahead and change. And Sam would go ahead and meet with you and talk about what your problem was, quote unquote, your sin. And when you decided that you wanted to go ahead and to have it removed and you wanted help with it and you surrendered, it was then that Sam would introduce you to one of these small groups. He didn't take somebody that was 15 minutes sober and drop them into the middle of a group of people. He wanted you to settle down, to make your own commitment, to surrender. And then if he felt the time was right, very seldom was it a single operation. Most of the time, it was a series of meetings, and we'll get to that later on. Moody, Mott, Meyer, Wright, and Bookman all knew that small groups was the best way to build a fellowship. You could have big meetings and have a lot of people in there, but if you wanted to get down to the nitty-gritty, you had to put small people together, 20, 25 people. That was fine for a discussion group. I go into some of these meetings, and I went to a step meeting the other day, 120 people at a discussion meeting. I'm sorry, it doesn't work. Everybody's so worried about how they're going to sound good that they don't get into it. When you get into a small room, Sam tried to personally interview everybody, like I said. Not all will be saved. He understood that, too. These people develop mutual respect, a commonality, and confidence. And sometimes they would take a group and split it up into even smaller groups. And Sam sometimes would go in, but a lot of times he was just out in the hallway. He was focusing on faith, and the small groups felt the fellowship that he thought people needed. The Emmanuel movement had relied on this type of thing with common problems before 1915. The Jacobi Club had small aftercare groups affiliated with it, which were for recovering alcoholics. He encouraged a guy who was a member of his church, uneducated guy, Ralston Young. He was a red cap. He used to carry your luggage in Grand Central Station. And after a while, Ralston had he was evidently quite a charming guy, and worked with the church on a lot of aspects. He got one of the railroad companies to let him use a railroad car during the day on Track 13 in Grand Central Station. And people would have small prayer meetings there. And they called him the Bishop of Grand Central Station. But he still had to move your bags. But Red Cap 42, small groups work best. Meet the people where they are. That goes way back. That goes back to the apostles. And the Jesuits were that way, too. But, I mean, that's also what Ralston Young was. So it was an unchurched religion, an evangelist-type situation. He started up the Faith at Work group. He knew a lot of Ivy alumni in New York City in the business community who had spiritual needs, possibly knew them personally. But the Sunday sermons weren't doing it for them. And so he knew there was room for Christ in the workplace. So he developed Faith at Work group meetings starting around 1926. Okay? He drew these spiritual seekers in business to Cavalry for small faith-based meetings. Faith at Work members shared spiritual strength, personal growth experiences, and teamed up on witnessing and bringing work into their daily workplace. Some of the people, Shep Cornell, he was an alcoholic, possibly, but I don't think so, towards the end. He was the head of A.O. Smith, which in the end was one of the largest water heating manufacturers in the world. Seba Graves was a lawyer. You've heard of him before. Robert Elliott Speer would come. He wrote the Four Absolutes. He was on the staff over at Princeton, and then he became an evangelist. Victor Kitchen, the guy down there, he was in the advertising business. He had been an alcoholic, and he had stopped drinking, and he wrote I Was a Pagan. And Philip Marshall Brown, one of my favorite guys, was not an alcoholic for sure, but he was a brilliant man. Williams graduate, taught at Princeton, taught at Harvard, was a diplomat for 10 years overseas. And this was the type of person. These were guys who had good lives, and but they were seekers, and they wanted to help people, and they did it themselves. go back here once more. I got I left off anybody out of that group. Faith at Work was a contributing element to the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll get to that later. His net opened wide, Sam's net, and he as the word spread, more people were coming to Calvary House because they felt that they could find a place for themselves. Issues were diverse, but they all had solutions in Christ. Sam counseled each man and woman, like I said before, he let them into the group. He stood by the door, stepped back, and let God perform his work. He never let up on one-on-one personal counseling and conversation. If you read his books, most of his books are just relating, working with one person on a particular issue and how they solved it with Christ. He didn't tell them what to do. He just opened a few doors for them. And it's remarkable. Sometimes he worked with people for years before they came around. And when I say came around, it was not just to go ahead to deal with alcoholism, because very few of these people were. He initiated, with Faith at Work, initiated Evangel Magazine, which mentored the missions in Calvary Church. He also was giving daily radio talks. He spoke nationally at schools and colleges and conferences, visited seminaries and seminarians, try to convert some. And one would be wrong if they thought that he was a purely Oxford group guy. His goal was to help any and all men and women who wish to find Christ by any means necessary. Once again, everybody has a problem. Whatever keeps us from living loving relationship with other people or from a vital and open relationship with God is a sin. That was his theory. So, and he knew that all sins were not created equal. Alcoholism was a primary sin for him, which had to be dealt with before others, because you couldn't be drinking and then address the rest of the things in your life. Now, he wasn't an abstinence guy for people who didn't have problems, but if you had a problem, maybe you had to go ahead and put that away first. And I think that alcoholism topped his hierarchy of sins. It wasn't a simple moral issue. It required God's grace. He knew that. Soul surgery could be helpful, that the five C's, but the alcoholic had to get to a point where they stopped. There was no tapering off. The alcoholism, progressive mental, physical, and spiritual components created messy attitudes and behaviors. But they can't be changed until the alcoholic can stay sober. He knew that few alcoholics would be struck sober. Granted, some people are, but too few to count. And he knew that from the Emmanuel Church and the Jacobi Group and others, that most alcoholics can stop for one day. And sobriety is the solution, achieved with surrender, abstinence, and maintained with prayer, meditation, spiritual change, restitution, reconstruction, and fellowship. Fellowship with those similarly afflicted, akin to, we go back again, to the Washingtonians, beneficial abstinence. The people you're hanging with, if they have the same problem, you can both go ahead and help solve that problem. He knew from previous recovery efforts, as well as his colleague, Henry Hadley, that sober alcoholics work best with others seeking sobriety. Sam was at all this time when he's doing this stuff, he is writing books. I mean, he started, the first book that I have is Realizing Religion, which I believe he wrote around 1920. It was before he became ordained. But he was a magnificent communicator. Here are just a couple of his books: How to Become a Christian and Thy Neighbor, Revive the Church, Beginning with Me, Courage to Change, Religion That Works. He was always working. He used to go ahead and keep notes on little 3x5 cards and file them away under headings. So when he was writing something later on, he could go ahead and go back to that little file. He was a multitasker before multitasking became normal. Now, Sam Shoemaker, he delivered a message. He was a face-to-face guy in most cases, in print also. And he was on the streets and in schools and then over the radio. At the end, his book succeeded over 30 titles. Accounts by others give deep insight into his activities, which he did not publicize, and he left few fingerprints. Some of the books: Children of the Second Birth in 1927, multiple examples of surrender, conversion, and change of all types and all religions, sharing a spiritual journey and seeking relief from personal sin. I Stand by the Door was written by his wife, Helen Shoemaker, and it gives a nice profile. And she quotes an awful lot of his stuff, so it's a lot of the text is actually his. But it's an in-house view of how he developed and how he was able to adapt from being a student missionary to a national treasure and staying right size throughout the 40 years of his ministry. He never lost sight of his personal mission to introduce any interested man or woman to God. The Breeze of the Spirit by his associate Irving Harris reveals the nitty-gritty of his mechanics on how he went ahead and he set this thing up. New Light on Alcoholism by Dick B. is extensively researched. It's a lot of information in there, but basically it does, you can find his still under-recognized influence on Alcoholics Anonymous. From his early years, he was a member of that first century Christian fellowship. He merged the Oxford practices into his own personal ministry. The soul surgery techniques he used is basically like blocking and tackling. He likes surrender, prayer, meditation. Change men, change lives were molded by Sam to fit the way of the Cavalry Church and faith at work. As Sam advanced on at Cavalry in the Episcopal Church, his participation with the Oxford group ebbed and flowed. He wasn't always leading the parade. I mean, he had a lot of things going at the same time. One of the things with the Oxford group is that they did go ahead and encourage their followers to become parts of members of other churches. Here's one of the Oxford group from the 20s. This is probably from the early 30s. The yellow arrow is Sam. The gold arrow on the back is Frank Bookman. I believe to Sam's left is his future wife. His wife, Helen Smith, he had met at Princeton when she was a teenager in 1918, and their paths crossed often. In 1928, she was with the Oxford group in England. Her father was big in the Oxford group way back when, and he was a diplomat. He ended up being a U.S. senator. But when Sam was over there, he asked her to help come back to New York and help out with Cavalry because he had a lot of young women that needed help. She resisted at first, but came back to Cavalry in 1929. An independent spirit, she was a very close friend with an early Oxford grouper, Eleanor Ford, who ended up marrying Jim Newton later on. But she could hold her own, and she did it for years, I'll tell you. Sam himself was first a man of God. His guidance came from God and not from Bookman. Cavalry had its own staff, accommodated the Oxford group, and gave it an American home. But they did not drive that bus, I'll tell you. The Cavalry Church was Cavalry Church. And Sam and Helen participated in Oxford group activities and the house parties right up through 1940. This is another typical Oxford group party in the 30s. They were held at hotels, country clubs, and resorts. They lasted 5 days to 2 weeks, often with 100 to over 600 people in the course of an event. Within a year of coming back to New York, Helen and Sam were engaged at an Oxford group house party at Briarcliff Mansion in January of 1930 and married in April. Briarcliff actually was a Trump resort as of late. To Sam, Christianity, the Cavalry Episcopal Church, the Oxford group, and mankind were indivisible. He didn't like to have people say, that's mine, that's yours. Faith at Work was not an Oxford group team, it was the Sam team. Later on, they ended up calling themselves Luminous, and their headquarters still continues in Virginia. Cavalry Episcopal Church was not an Oxford group church. They were welcome there. But Cavalry Episcopal Church was Cavalry Episcopal Church. It was separate. The Oxford group was separate from any sect, but they encouraged their individual members to join local churches and stay active. Faith at Works was not primarily for alcoholics nor for Oxford group members. It was just a special interest group at Cavalry, spiritually based. Physically, mentally, and spiritually, moral components and solutions were well known prior to the Oxford group. That's why it was called a first century Christian fellowship. You can find writings about the first century Christian fellowship back in the early 1900s from Reverend Worcester, etc. And sometimes we think that we invented the alphabet, for Christ's sake. It's there were phrases that were used by a lot of people that the further you go back, the more you'll find that there's nothing new in Alcoholics Anonymous. Today's abstinence and sobriety practices evolved from common mankind's past experiences, wins and losses, reformatted and repackaged for today's use and application. Sam continued to form many small groups to meet the needs of his people, and he relied on lay facilitators from within the groups. His small focus groups flourished and continue to be a great example. Just think of NA, AA, OA, GA, SLAA, and all of the other self-help groups. My old sponsor, Father Bob, used to call them, they're not self-help groups, they're God-help groups. Because everybody has a problem, and a problem has to live with the problem, is a problem and has to live with the problem. It's a guy, Jim Newton, you maybe have heard of him. He was an early Oxford grouper. He had been personally recruited by Harvey Firestone to join his firm. He was a friend of Thomas Edison and Henry Ford, et cetera. He's a young guy. And he went into Firestone, and he was rising up within the Firestone company. While he was out there in Akron, he joined a church, because that's what the Oxford group did. And the church he joined was the Church of Harvey Firestone, which was St. Paul's Episcopal Church, whose rector was Reverend Walter Tunks, as suggested. You know, in 1927, while he was on a visit to New York, he reportedly met with Frank Bookman and said that he was a little bit adrift. Of course, he was sort of in an outpost out there in Akron. He didn't have a lot of people around him that he was close to. Bookman sent him up to see Sam Shoemaker at Cavalry Church and see if Sam could be of help. And Sam brought him into the Faith at Work businessmen's group that we went through before, that were meeting regularly at Cavalry House. And Newton connected with the attendees, such as Philip Marshall Brown and Hanford Twitchell, et cetera. And in the Faith at Work group became his away team. Now we're going to jump to another person, Roland Hazard. He was a son from a Rhode Island family that rose to prominence, Yale-educated, personal, extreme wealth. In trouble with alcohol deeply by the 20s. He became treatment at private sanitariums throughout the 20s. He kept on trying to find out how to learn how to drink and save. He had one guy that was draining his spinal fluid. So he said that the doctor said that if he relieved the pressure of the spinal fluid, he wouldn't have a problem with alcohol. Of course, Roland kept on writing him checks because God forbid that he had to stop drinking. Roland's cousins and classmates already had troubles with alcoholism. They knew that abstinence was the only help. They tried to help the golden boy, as I call him, and he went on a trip. So you read about some of the stuff that he did, the things that he tried to do, the geographical cures and the quack cures as he reeled through the roaring 20s. He was something else. By 1934, he had visited everybody, the best sanitariums and doctors in America. Had twice been to with Young in Zurich and with Baines in California and Baylor in Boston and possibly even Richard Peabody and definitely Sam Shoemaker. All knew him. You got to remember, Sam was a classmate of his brother, Tom, too. In May of 1926, Hazard and his wife had been in the care of Carl Jung in Zurich. But in 1927 to 34, he continually sought relief but not sobriety from others, including Baylor, but it didn't work. In Boston and Vermont in 1934, Baylor finally didn't give up, but just said, why don't you go ahead and go back down and see Sam Shoemaker? He might be able to help you. Sam had a strong moral compass, and he could follow through on these things. He had already received guidance to take a six-month sabbatical from Cavalry to go ahead and to do some Oxford group work throughout North America. And he returned in time for Easter on April 1st, 1934. That sort of will set the time frame, because that means that Roland wasn't going to go and find him prior to April 1st. This is documented by his wife. He was all over the United States. It was probably right after Easter, because he was the rector of a church, so he didn't have time during Holy Week to go ahead and to deal with a lot of people, that Roland Hazard once again sought him out, and they began to talk one-on-one. Sam knew that Christ would relieve Roland's sins. Sam spent quality time with Roland in his own personal way. And like I say, that a number of visits over a period of time, not a quick one and done, kneel down. It doesn't work that way, at least for Sam Shoemaker. begin back here. I have he was skilled on one-on-one interviews. His soul surgery work. The 54-year alcoholic Roland Hazard had not stayed sober more than a few months despite treatment by the best doctors. Sam played on Roland's ego, drew him in, and made him feel special. He gained his trust under some intensive care and interviews, and Hazard surrendered to Christ, admitted he could not drink in safety, and asked Christ to change his life. Roland came into the Oxford Group and the Faith at Work business meetings then in 1934. Sam almost immediately took Roland on a number of special Oxford Group tours to Canada and Mid-America with select sober peers from Calvary's Faith at Work and Oxford Groups in 1934. Here's a newspaper clipping my friend Drew sent me the other day. It came from Canada, from Winnipeg. And Oxford Group leaders arrive in city Friday, and among them was Roland Hazard and a bunch of people, including Eleanor Ford, etc. And they were there for a week to 10 days, had open meetings, closed meetings. They preached at local churches, and they had the newspapers were filled with interviews from these people. Bookman sometimes would join them towards the end to sort of give a big wrap-up speech. But it wasn't necessarily the way it was. But Sam Shoemaker was part of this, and he made sure that he played his role in it. And they stayed at a house party. Look at this. The lead at the house party at Kilmore, Lady Nanton's house. That was the type of people that they were drawing on. Limited guests were invited to the closed meetings. Open meetings are planned in the cities next week. Out of this is my athletic end of things. I called Sam Shoemaker the coach of the year for 1934 and 1935. And his team was right here. His team was Roland Hazard, Ebby Thatcher, and Bill Wilson. That was the fall of 1934. In the late summer, following one of the Oxford team tours, Peter Marshall Brown, Shep Cornell, Seba Graves were at Roland's Vermont home when they decided to intervene in a court hearing of Seba's friend, Ebby Thatcher, in Bennington. Someone, and I say question mark, because nobody's going to tell me who showed up in the court. I just don't think that Roland Hazard would walk in. I do think that Shep Cornell and Seba Graves did show up. They went in and they talked to the judge, who happened to be Seba's father, probably in chambers, because you don't bring this stuff up. If you're going to make a deal, you can't make it in the open courtroom. You make it in at the sidebar or in the judge's chamber. And they promised that they would get Ebby out of town. They had found out how to control their drinking. They'd like to go ahead and help him. And I believe Seba's father just went ahead and said, if you can take care of him, fine, but please get him out of my county right now. And they did. And they took him back to the house, and then they took him down to New York. And a dried-out Ebby was brought to Calvary Mission for the down and outers. He moved into the mission, got some housing, got active staying sober, and attended mission, the Oxford Mission Group and Faith at Work. He turned his life over to God, and by helping others, he hoped it would work for him. Now, Sam, from Emmanuel, knew that alcoholics listen best to alcoholics, and that's why he had Hadley there. Ebby, because he had been wealthy, although he was pretty much a down and outer, became one of the few mission residents who possibly crossed over into Faith at Work and Oxford Group meetings. So the time came, sober just a few months, he was probably encouraged by his Oxford Group friends to help somebody out. And his old drinking friend, Bill Wilson, came to mind, living in Brooklyn. Prep school classmates since 1912, they had kept in touch. Both had grown growing alcohol problems and had shared drunken episodes and self-induced bad luck. Both had reached their bottoms, however, it's doubtful that either knew it. So a newly sober visited Bill Wilson at home. Bill was surprised that he was sober, but he was happy. He told him to keep it up. Bill knew from Silkworth that he was an alcoholic and he could never drink in safety. And he reconfirmed that again by drinking again in November on Armistice Day. Days after Ebby visited, he, Bill, and a friend drank themselves across town to find Ebby at Cavalry Mission. Ebby kept the disruptive Bill from being thrown out. They stayed for the service where a drunk Bill claimed he was saved but he didn't stop drinking. In December, a drunk Bill returned to Towns Hospital for the third or fourth drying out. Days later, Ebby visited him again, and once again related how he had stopped drinking. That's in the book. Bill listened this time, and the concept of asking God for help began to take hold. After a few days of detox and a white light experience, Bill left Towns Hospital and sought Ebby and his friends. Back at the mission, possibly Ebby started to introduce him to some of the people around him. Ebby enabled Bill Wilson's introduction to cavalry and eventually to Sam Shoemaker, Faith at Work, Roland Hazard, Shep Cornell, Seabird Graves, and Victor Kitchen. Sam sensed that Bill would just might fit in with this Faith at Work group. Bill certainly saw himself as a match. Conversion was needed for Bill to be brought into the Christian-centered Faith at Work, so Sam probably spent some time interviewing Bill in a series of one-on-one conversion meetings like he had done with so many other people. Bill, although it's not documented, turned his life to Christ, to Sam, but Sam is in an earlier 1935 letter implies it occurred, and he thanked Bill for helping Professor Beer Hunt get sober. This is a similar tactic Sam used on Bill Wilson to get him front and center, making him feel special, like he had done with Roland by putting him on some of those tours. Sam was standing by the door for alcoholics years before they arrived. He knew the key for removing sin was total surrender, accompanied with dramatic life changes, conversion actions, and continuance. In his term, alcohol abuse qualified as a sin. Sam knew that with daily abstinence, prayer, and meditation, God could, if asked, remove any problem. Sam wasn't concerned whether alcoholism was an allergy, an addiction, or a disease, but he knew it as a sin. And alcoholism occasioned moral failures, and relief was beyond man's help. Sam helped Roland admit he could no longer drink in safety, and that surrender to Christ was his only help. Same thing he did with Bill Wilson. Now I'm going to jump again. Jim Newton. We saw him in 1927 when he visited. Jim Newton, an early Bookman disciple, was in New York from Akron and talked with Frank, who directed him to Sam at Faith and Works. Jim's pastor was Reverend Tunks. He returned on a return from an Episcopal convention. Jim Newton had the alcoholic Bud Firestone in tow, and they met up with Sam on a train, who in private conversations converted Bud, who stopped drinking. Harvey Firestone, grateful for Sam and Jim's influence on his son, sponsored a full Oxford mission to Akron in 1933, where Bookman was greeted by the Reverend Walter Tunks. Henrietta Sieverling, Ann Smith, T. Henry Williams were among the Akron locals who were impressed by the Oxford group, and they became Akron core group leaders in 1933. In 1935, a 5 month sober Bill W. is going to Akron. Was the Reverend Tunks a suggested contact by Sam Shoemaker? If you had a sponsee going from New York to Akron who was shaky, and you knew Jim Newton and Reverend Tunks because you had known them before, would you possibly go ahead and give those numbers to Bill Wilson? That's what I would do. Otherwise, I'd feel kind of like I'd throw them into the wolves. But he got a hold of Tunks, who directed him to Henrietta Sieverling, who introduced Bill to Dr. Bob in her home. The non-alcoholic T. Henry Williams held sobriety-focused Oxford group subgroups in his home, which eventually evolved into some of the first true meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's a copy of the general convention that Jim brought Bud Firestone out to the train. He got him on a train full of Episcopals and converted him. Firestone knew that this was going to work for him, and he was the one that underwrote the thing. I'm sorry I got a little bit lost on this one. I think this one's out of sight. But they had a strong Oxford group beachhead in Akron. So we're influenced by Sam Shoemaker whenever we go ahead and we read the big book. As they went ahead, they were putting together the thoughts for the book. In Alcoholics Anonymous, Comes of Age, Bill Wilson writes, "It was now realized that we had enough background and window dressing material, and at this point we would have to tell our program tell how our program for recovering alcoholics really worked. The background of the book would have to be fitted in right here. This problem had secretly worried the life out of me, says Bill. I never had written anything before, and neither had any other members of our New York group. Well, let's see who did. Bill Wilson was an undegreed man whose pre-AA writings were limited to profile reports on promising American businesses, which he wrote during his frenetic business career. Prior to 35, I'm not aware of Bill having any acquaintance with authors or friends with any literary talent, let alone being intimately familiar with the religious and spiritual practices necessary for addressing alcoholism and addictions that AA later found necessary for maintaining sobriety. In 1937, sober only 2 years, Bill Wilson was meeting regularly with Reverend Sam and had made the acquaintance of Oxford Group writers Victor Hitchin and perhaps A.J. Russell. Shoemaker was a 44-year-old Princeton graduate and priest, well-traveled missionary with 25 years of experience in spiritual living and counseling others. Sam had written and published a dozen books, was known internationally as a speaker, evangelical missionary worker, bridged the gap between church and personal witnessing, surrender, and conversion techniques. Sam followed the principles of first-century Christianity. Biographers detailed his discipline in maintaining his notes and complicated schedule. A multitasker ahead of his time, he could pivot as priorities changed. Sam, there's just some more of his books. Is it conceivable that as Bill drafted the first 179 pages of the Big Book, that he discussed the concept and the structure and text with a learned and sympathetic ear of the only man he knew who had written and published a dozen spiritual books and had crafted and delivered 1,000 sermons? Is it possible that Sam suggested words and phrases, adds and deletes, and rephrased drafts and prayers drawn from his own decades of total immersion in the spiritual life? Did Sam share some of his thoughts and guidances with Bill during the writings of Alcoholics Anonymous, as he had with so many others over the years? Bill is remarkably quiet on this, not mentioning any consultations or chats as the AA book was being written. But it still doesn't mean that he didn't meet often with him. Reverend Irving Harris, he and his wife were in that church. He ran Faith at Work and the magazine Evangel. In the book, they talked about Sam and Bill meeting regularly in Sam's book-lined seventh-floor study with the door closed and the telephone shut off. And in Dick B's book, and I don't know how, I think he's passed away, but it says, Sam's personal notebooks from April 1936 through April of 1939 have been lost or misplaced from the Shoemaker family records. So what do you think? I got this picture. I don't know where it came from. I didn't make it up. I don't know if it's Photoshopped or if it's real, to be honest with you. But what do you think about that? Frank Bookman started to move the Oxford group towards getting involved in politics. Sam wanted to go ahead and stick with the first century Christian fellowship. So the Cavalry Church directed the Oxford group to move from Cavalry in 1941. Sam was in full stride with his own ministry. In the 40s, he was nationally known. The Shoemakers, actually, the little coincidence, they had bought a weekend home in Bedford, New York, near Stepping Stones in 1930. And I wonder if Bill and Sam ever took the train back and forth from New York to Bedford on weekends. He was always a valued contributor to the Grapevine at Bill's urging and attended AA events as a special guest and a speaker in major gatherings. I wonder if Father Dowling and Ed and Sam ever had much contact besides AA conventions. Both were fascinating non-alcoholics, and they provided some checks and balances to Bill. Sam related tongue-in-cheek that one didn't talk with Bill Wilson. You listen. Sam continued on his game. He was still out there reaching to develop new evangelical priests. And Reverend Ashley wrote of Sam stalking the aisles at the Episcopal Theology School in Cambridge in 1950, encouraging its students to go listen to evangelist Billy Graham in Boston. Sam considered Graham a friend and ally for Christ. He didn't worry about the religions, what sect you were doing. He knew that one-on-one that Billy was doing the job. It was Billy in Boston. After all these years and all of these achievements, Sam was rejected for a couple of major Episcopal positions, including rector of the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. So after 26 years in New York City, Sam and Helen and their two daughters left New York City for Calvary Episcopal Church in Pittsburgh, a new challenge in a new city. This is Calvary Episcopal Church. It was once again a worn-down church, but he brought life back into it. And this time he went after a different group of people. He went after young people, not necessarily with problems. And within a very short period of time, he had the Pittsburgh experiment going, an experiment for faith, the handbook for beginners. And they had first appeared as a derivative of Faith at Work for business meetings. But in Pittsburgh, more of the members were younger men and women, mid-management and junior executives. They met in small groups throughout the city. God would be the same thing to Pittsburgh as steel as to Pittsburgh was Sam's wish. Within a few years, men and women were meeting throughout the region. And Sam led Bible studies at the Harvard, Yale, and Princeton Club. And the Pittsburgh Club, Pittsburgh Experience, still operates after more than 65 years. Sam and Helen retired to Burnside in 61 for his final years. Sam passed quietly in October of 1963 and was buried in St. Thomas Episcopal Church in Owens Mills. Friends and tributes arrived from around the world. Memorial services were held nationwide. January 31st is celebrated as an Episcopal Church feast day for Reverend Sam Shoemaker just a couple of weeks ago. On the passing of Sam Shoemaker, Norman Vincent Peale said, "No man ever excelled Sam Shoemaker in sheer spiritual and depth and pervasive power. Sam was perhaps the most gifted genius and intimate personal invent of evangelism in our lives." Billy Graham said, "Words cannot express adequately." And listen to some of these phrases. These are guys that write this stuff all the time. "The sense of personal loss I have felt at the homegoing of our beloved Sam. What a blessing it has been to talk and especially to pray with this giant among men. I doubt that any man in our generation has made a greater impact for God in the Christian world than did Sam Shoemaker. When a great and good man sets, the sky of the world is luminous long after he is out of sight. Such a man cannot die out of this world. When he goes, he leaves behind him much of himself." And Bill Wilson talking to Nikki Shoemaker in the driveway at Burnside. Said, "Don't let anyone ever tell you that I founded AA. If it wasn't for Sam Shoemaker, AA would never have been born." "Our ideas of self-examination, acknowledgement of character defects, restitution for harm done, and working with others came straight from Sam. He gave it to us, the concrete knowledge of what we could do about our illness. He passed to us the spiritual keys by which so many of us have been liberated." And he stepped away from the door, but his work is still around. His beneficial guidance remains in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I ran a little bit over my time, but that's it. Thank you.